Speciale Venezia. Emily Jaisir è nata nel 1970 a Betlemme. Cresciuta in Arabia Saudita, oggi vive fra Ramallah, in Palestina, e New York. A febbraio del 2007 è stata invitata a partecipare a System Error, War is a Force that Gives Us Meaning, una mostra curata da Naim Mohayemen e Lorenzo Fusi al Palazzo delle Papesse di Siena.
Fra i lavori che sono stati portati in mostra per System Error, Material for a Film è forse il lavoro al quale sono più legato. Non perché sia migliore o peggiore di altri, ma semplicemente perché ha forte senso presentare in Italia questa opera, perché gli eventi a cui fa riferimento sono proprio tutti italiani.
Questa è l'audioguida di System Error. L'opera della Jaisir racconta l'assassinio di Wael Zuaiter, ucciso a Roma nel 1972 dagli agenti del Mossad, i servizi segreti israeliani, in seguito al massacro delle Olimpiadi di Monaco del 72, in cui la squadra israeliana fu sequestrata e uccisa da un comando di terroristi palestinesi. Zuaiter fu la prima vittima della serie di omicidi mirati all'eliminazione dei presunti mandanti della strage e fu colpito da 12 proiettili di calibro 22 mentre rientrava nella sua abitazione di Roma la notte del 16 ottobre. Un tredicesimo proiettile si formò in una copia delle Mille e una notte che Zuaiter aveva nella tasca della giacca e che stava traducendo dall'arabo in italiano.
Questo libro ancora oggi esiste, quindi Emily ha fotografato tutte le pagine di quel libro fino a dove si vedeva la traccia del proiettile, cioè si vedeva la traiettoria o la marca lasciata, o l'impronta lasciata dal proiettile. L'altra parte, che invece è più prettamente scultorea, Emily ha preso 1000 libri bianchi, quindi naturalmente un'evidente allusione ai racconti della Mille e una Notte, si è fatta insegnare, ha preso lezioni di tiro, ha preso una calibro 22 e ha personalmente sparato a tutte 1000 libri per vedere che tipo di traiettorie i proiettili potevano avere con quel tipo di pistola all'interno di quei libri. Per cui c'è una doppia commemorazione, diciamo così, di un evento che è abbastanza passato sotto in sordina, comunque del quale non si parla molto spesso, avvenuto in territorio italiano, ma che naturalmente fa riferimento a uno dei conflitti principe che traggono maggiormente l'attenzione dei media, ma poi le storie personali, individuali di ciascuno dei protagonisti o delle vittime naturalmente di quel conflitto spesso viene ignorata. Quindi era un modo per riraccontare in territorio italiano un evento storico che è successo proprio in Italia.
Emily Jaisir è stata invitata da Robert Storr a partecipare alla 52esima Biennale di Venezia e nel Padiglione Italia, all'interno della mostra internazionale, ha creato un'altra installazione del ciclo Material for a Film. L'abbiamo incontrata ancora una volta e Lorenzo Fusi l'ha intervistata. Insieme hanno parlato di Material for a Film, di come nasce il progetto della Biennale di Venezia e del suo lavoro come artista. L'intervista è in inglese. Buon ascolto!
I think what we might start talking is the evolution of a piece, which seems to become like a work in progress. Of course, we have been hosting and installing and presenting one part of a work in Siena, and I see there's an incredible evolution in terms of a collection of memorials, materials, and documentation in this new piece. Well, probably we should talk a little bit about the origins of a piece as well, and how it's gradually sedimenting and developing.
What, to go back to the origins of the piece, there's two moments. One is in 1998, I acquired Janet Van Brown's book For a Palestinian. And in that book, there was a chapter by Elio Petri and Ugo Piro called Material for a Film, in which they had interviewed all the people close to Wael in his life. But at that moment in time, I was more interested in trying to develop a project about all the Palestinians who were killed on European soil. So at that period, I mean, I had this book because I was collecting information about the different people and photographs and finding people, and then I found this amazing book that Janet edited. And then, I guess, 2004, 2005, things boiled down to the focus on Wael himself. So it started with this idea of going back to Rome 30 years later and continuing this work of Elio Petri and Ugo Piro of collecting information for a film. And also inspired by reading the interviews, but wanting more like the photographs, pictures. What? Where was he exactly in Rome? What were the streets he walked on? What did it look like? The colors and things like this. In that process of research, I found out about the story of the bullet hitting his 1001 nights. So that detail in and of itself inspired the entire project, which was in Siena. And there was because I was with Janet in September of 2005 when she told me the story. I had never known that. And she had kept that book hidden for 30 years and had recently donated it to Massa Carrara. And I went there just for this book alone. So, of course, there was this long period of, you know, this element of the book and wanting to do something specifically. It's hard to talk about it because it wasn't so divided. It was just, was one piece, but they're just...
Very organic.
Yeah, exactly. And then it just became, one was a performance based on one element of the story during my research, and the other one was this gathering of material for a film.
I think your work has been very much based... Either in collection of information or documentation, and I think text has an incredible importance within the either the narrative, but also the formal solution of the pieces. So, what's your relationship to literature, to writings, to text, in fact?
Actually, I'm going to respond to that in a minute because it's linked. What I want to say is that when I designed this installation, I tried to do it so that it was a documentary or a film about him, but in an installation format. So I designed the images and the photographs and the sound pieces, which are all going on at the same time and at different times, to sort of, I don't know if it was successful, but to try to move the viewer through the space as if you're walking through a film. This was the most important part of it. And also just the idea that it would be the skeleton of a film, that maybe someone who comes here can go in there and create a film from all of this material. But at the same time, the space itself is... A film. Now I lost your question.
The text.
Yeah.
Well, writing.
Yeah. I don't know how to answer this question, actually. No, that's an important question because it's... But yeah, let me come back to that question because it's really important.
Okay.
Let me see. The relationship to Janet, I'm very curious about it. It must have been an incredibly intense personal experience. Can you recall some moments or either verbal or unverbal communication or...
The first time... I met Janet was because I called Rada and I said, I have to meet the woman who wrote this book. Is she still in Rome? Yes, she still lives in Rome. Where is she? And she was in that moment at her own opening in Piazza del Popolo for her painting. So I went and introduced myself. And I think she was skeptical of me at first. Like, who's this woman that appeared out of nowhere? And, you know, but then she invited me to her home. And then over the course of several years, I was constantly going back and forth and spending a week or 2 weeks with her and going through the things she preserved of Wales. And at times it was extremely emotional, and I think actually really difficult for her because she was reliving many things she hasn't spoken about or even looked at physically for years. For example, I remember one of my visits, I was about to go to the airport, and I happened to see a cassette tape lying in this cabinet of hers that just said, Voice of Wael Zwaiter. And I was like, Janet... Is this a recording of his actual voice? And she was like, oh yeah.
Rappresentano una espressione pratica dell'estensione della contraddizione fra il movimento di resistenza e il regime giordano.
I mean, which seems like this would be the first thing you would want.
Right, proto, yeah.
And she was like, oh yeah, and then we played in the cassette player and she said, oh, that doesn't really sound like him anyway, you know? And then those bobina tapes, that was another thing. The police, after the investigation, gave her all the bobinas, which were her personal private phone being tapped. And she's held on to them. And actually, she still has not heard them. I said, please, please let me take these and transfer them and listen to this, to the recordings. I mean, many of them are conversations, two women discussing what they're going to cook for dinner. One woman's husband was cheating on her for 30 years. I don't know who these people are, but there was on one tape every phone call made to Janet after Wael's death. Elio Petri and Ugo Piro had interviewed, were calling, and that's all recorded. And then I think it's so strange, the police just gave her all the secretly tapped tapes. But on the other hand, it was great that the thing that was really wonderful about Janet is she's always wanted somebody to make a film about Wael. So she was really happy and excited that I was doing this work. It was really positive. I mean, I found in her archives she had written letters to Costas Gravas saying, I wish, you know, this is my book, this is the story of Wael, this is why I believe you should make this film. And she had one that was an outline for Elio Petri, and then she also told me that Moravia had agreed to write the script. I mean, this is something that she had wanted for a very long time.
I think the presentation of a piece both as has been in Siena and even more evidently so here, I think it's very important for the Italian audience as well, because it has been bringing back to on the surface of memory something that we all heard about, I mean, regardless of a generation, but something which was potentially there in our memory, but it was never really fully investigated, and it was actually very much lost amongst all of the amount of information we had back in times, and also because it was kind of coinciding with a very tense period for the Italian politics, where that kind of assassinations would have happened any other second. So it got very much confused and lost within that amount of domestic violence and information, and it was not never really metabolized in a little bit more wider context. So I really found it extremely important to bring it back now, at least to rethink of it. So I'm really grateful that you took the chance to write the material for the film, in fact. But I don't know now whether it would have been important to have it done, because I think, as you said, I mean, especially because of the installation or the thought of it, or the project, better said, has been developing so much, and it has been becoming so multifaceted, that is probably even more than what one single take, such as
exactly.
A film, would have been providing.
Right, that's
so
true.
To me, in a funny sort of way, the potential of this film, which is never there, but is actually, exactly, I find it so much more interesting, and it provides so many different readings, and everybody actually can recreate his own visual story from the storyboard.
Right, which is what I love as well. And, I mean, also during the installation, it was fantastic, because the people working for the Biennale that were coming in, I mean, just seeing the reaction of people from here, because everyone who saw Moravia immediately was drawn into this, Moravia, this was great. And friends of mine from Rome who are here are having a very specific reaction because of the photographs and the places and the spaces, and it's so familiar to them as well.
Yeah.
So, but I also like the idea that when Elio Petri and Ugo Piro started collecting this information, they felt that they were continuing Wael's work, because his dream was to make all the Italian filmmakers aware of the Palestinian story. So they were building on this. So then I like this idea that I build on what they did, and then maybe this would continue.
Right. And it's also very interesting to see all of the Palestina magazines, the one you were pointing out, that they were just absolutely amazing. Of course, I had no evidence, no memory, no direct personal experience of those, which proves how very much, you know, the bond between the two countries was quite solid in that time, and it makes it like double sense, in fact, just to represent it within our national border, especially in this one. In reason of the complexity of the material which is on show here, I mean, either audio, sound, and postcards, everything, I mean, text and everything we said, I imagine it must have been very, very difficult to find out a formal solution to create that kind of itinerary journey you were talking about. So how did you play with the material? How did you decide to... Was this a little bit more instinctual?
This was incredibly difficult. And this is actually where I did feel like a filmmaker this is before I started installing, because you have all this research and you know so much about this person and the people in his life.
Right.
And when a filmmaker makes a film, they cut so many things and you have to condense it to these specific moments. And that's what I had to do, obviously, before I came. And that, it was really difficult to do that or to choose. You can't put it all in. And then also when I came, I'm actually going back with a lot of stuff I came with, because, I mean, I designed the space before I came, and there were certain elements of the piece I had formally decided upon. And I knew that it was a matter of coming in here, putting those formal elements in, and then continuing from there, and being ready to edit on the site and decide things on the site once things were up. And that was more instinctual, and that was not something you can decide until you're doing it.
Right.
Going back to the audio guide, your work explained or contextualized, as we say, it seems like a little bit ironic, since it's so much about experiencing and just reading and going through the text, which is the question I had in mind for you before.
No, but I mean, this is linked also, for example, and there's really nothing I can do about this. I heard a lot of people say, oh, Spielberg's film Munich, and they link it to this, and it's not Spielberg's film Munich. It has nothing to do with this film. In fact, this research began much before his film was even out, and I disagree with the reading that some people have that this piece is linked to Spielberg's film, because it's not. I mean, there's these performative elements and the research elements and these narratives that have nothing to do with this film. It's upsetting that this narrative or this piece or the story is not allowed to just exist without that framework. Because I've seen some things people have written, oh, you know, Spielberg's Munich, and then this is the door they're wanting people to walk through to enter the piece, and I wish I could control that or stop that, but I can't.
But don't you think this is kind of, both a relationship, a power of blockbuster films and, of course, the film. I think that what the Spielberg film did in the first place on a mass level was to revitalize this memory one way or the other, whether the reading is good or not, whether there's a correct take or not. But definitely is a story which has been largely unsaid lately, and it was at least respoken. So that's probably why, kind of unconsciously or consciously or just for ignorance, in fact, I would say, an easy link or an easy passage to link to your work. There's one piece of yours, I mean, just kind of go back a little bit, and it's kind of linking again to this idea of writing and the letters. You know, you've got a lot of documentation of postcards and letters, like private correspondence, which I think is one of the most amazing elements of humanity, in fact. It's like, especially before emails. But also, it brings back to memory this other piece you had about the writing letters.
I think you're talking about Inbox, not sure, with the email paintings.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and that was, of course, making personal correspondence more public. But also the thing, I mean, I love letters, and I think the interesting thing about letters and postcards that we've lost is that they, when you get it, there's an implied distance or a space between you and the person writing it, and the email is exact. I mean, this could be from somebody in China or someone in the Arsenale. There's no sense of place or in space. When you mentioned the postcards, I was like, the other thing I should have mentioned about Jen is how incredibly generous
she has been
with all of this information and all these things she collected and kept. And not only just her, but all of his friends. Like Ennio Polito was like, may I take these magazines and exhibit them? And he was like, yes, you know. And the people in Massa Carrara that have the book, I mean, fantastic. It's been great. So, and of course, the piece would never have happened without Janet and these other people and their generosity.
Well, one question which is more related to the biennial in general. Basically, the Venice Biennial, it seems like to be the prototype in a way, also because it was the biennial. But it is the only one which has kept so vividly this idea of nationalism and the division of pavilions and... which, of course, is very difficult to cope or to accept nowadays. It's basically a sense of division of culture or intellectual activity, which is very difficult to accept. They could be divided according to nationality. And you're in a sort of a privileged position because at least you got in the international show.
I feel really lucky to be in this. I mean, I'm glad I'm here. I mean, I knew the show would be divided between Arsenale and Padiglione d'Italia, and I, with the piece, I said I have to be in this building because of the history. But
what do you think? Do you think it should be changed, or do you think there would be a new formula, or do you think it's just because it's tradition, we shouldn't even question it? I really find it sort of an incredible contradiction there, because it's like, you know, we're pushing hard on the next.
I know, and I don't know if I can answer this question right now, actually, because I feel I keep changing my mind about that, and sometimes I'm very critical of these national pavilions. And on the other hand, sometimes I think, yeah, but it's really interesting. It's a European biennial, it's a European project, and you can make really incredible work in those national pavilions in Europe, in this European biennial. So I feel really... Plus each one, I don't know, it's actually, we could talk for 2 hours about this, because the way each one functions is... Some have their government artists, and it's not open to anybody else. I mean, it's so... No, it's just because I can't. It's such a difficult question, just because of what I was saying before. But I don't want to mention names, actually.
No,
but this, the way some of these pavilions are functioning and the kind of conditions certain artists are forced to work on. I have artists and friends in some pavilions that are working in the worst conditions. Their countries are picking the government artists and happen to pick them as well. And are forcing all these conditions onto them and actually changing their artworks. But they're in such a position in their country that they want to figure out some way to interrupt and insert. But anyone walking around the pavilions would not know any of these things.
Yeah. Which is probably unavoidable. And then
it's different from, yeah, but it's different from... then you would compare it to another country where the setup is completely different. Right. So...
Yeah.
And then countries that don't exist, countries not on maps, countries without nationalities. Yeah, I think every year they propose a Palestinian pavilion, but never goes through.
I wonder why.
Radio Papesse è un progetto di Ilaria Gadens, Carola Haupt e Cristiano Maggi.